The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 28. Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show. Hello, everyone. How are we doing this evening? We're going to have a lot of fun tonight for sure. Guys, make sure you check out the website when you guys get a chance, if you haven't already done so, and subscribe to the email list. I'm personally emailing everyone the videos and putting in some commentary that you're not going to find on YouTube. And in the future, we're going to provide exclusive content that you won't find on YouTube for those people that are on that list. So you want to make sure you get on there ASAP. Lastly, I'm super stoked. I don't know if you guys were here last week, but I talked about Marin Katusa's research letter, and I've been diving into that and trying to figure some stuff out for my own investment portfolio. And we may get lucky. I've been talking to his people back and forth, but I may actually have the opportunity to interview him this week. So stay tuned for that. I'm going to interview him myself, be honest, more out of selfish reasons, to have him just go through his letter and kind of show me the ropes and the value that I can get out of it. So stay tuned for that. All right, let's go right into the questions. How would you short the S&P? Seems like an easy way to make a buck. I would not short the S&P. No way would I short the S&P, because the Fed can pump in as much liquidity as they want. I'm not saying that that will for sure help, but you don't want to fight the Fed. And you always have to remember that just because the stock market doesn't goes up, you can always lose purchasing power. So in other words, if you short the market, it can go up on you, it can double on you, but you still lose purchasing power if you would have been long. So both the shorts and the longs lose. You can imagine what would have happened if you would have shorted the Venezuelan stock market when they first started their hyperinflation. You would have gotten your butt handed to you. So I just think it's if you want to do that with a small portion of your portfolio that's allocated to speculation, maybe. But the only way that I would do it, if I had some hedges, so I had some long hedges to combat that. But I don't know. That's really if you know what you're doing. Okay, question. Do you think it's the right time to invest in oil stocks? Well, the way I'd answer that is you just have to ask yourself if it's cheap. And that's where you start. Is it cheap or expensive? And you do that based on historical terms. But again, I don't want to use the word invest. Unless you can get an oil stock that's paying you a lot of money to own it, where you're very confident that you're going to get that dividend for a long period of time, it's, in my opinion, it's not really an investment. It's more a speculation. So if you think that the oil stocks are really, really super cheap right now, and when I mean cheap, I mean historically. I don't mean cheap because you think they're going to go up. That's not, you could look at Tesla stock right now, and some people would say that's quote unquote cheap. But if you look at a historical chart, it's by no means cheap. So that you got to make sure that you're defining that the correct, well, I'm not going to say the correct way, but the way that I would like to define it for my own portfolio. Question, do you believe the precious metals markets are being manipulated? Yes, I do. But I think that if you look at the latest deal with JP Morgan, the evidence would indicate that they're manipulating on both sides, the long side and the short side. So I don't know if there's an effort to keep the price of oil down. I just think that there's an effort to continually manipulate it up and down to make profit. So, but I have an open mind. If someone comes to me, with some more proof that says, "Hey, George, look at this. They're definitely pushing the market down, and they're doing it on purpose." Then, I'm open to that. I'm not saying that there's no way that that's happening. Okay, Baxter has a super chat. Thank you, Baxter. Any thoughts on shorting the Shanghai exchange because of the coronavirus? It's the same thing, Baxter. I mean, from a fundamental standpoint, it makes sense. But I'd be hesitant, number one, because you got to figure that's baked into the market already. And number two, their stimulus, we're just in this, the markets are in this mindset where the larger the balance sheet goes of the central banks, the stock market
goes up in tandem. So I just like I said to the other individual that I would hate to fight the Fed, I would also hate to fight the People's Bank of China. And also too, because, you know, they can go in there and buy stocks. I remember the video that I did with Kyle on Kyle Bass. If you guys saw that, I know that was a really popular video the other day. And, you know, he's short Hong Kong, but he's not shorting the market because he's very worried that the government can go and buy their market and just a lot of financial shenanigans. So he's just doing it by shorting the Hong Kong dollar. And I don't know how he's executing that trade. But the bottom line is, although every single thing that you look at in the stock market today, whether it's in China, Hong Kong, the United States, it's all just a blaring short. It's tough to do it. It's really tough to do it unless you really know what you're doing and you're hedged. So even if it does go up substantially, you're not getting your butt handed to you. Tony, thank you for the super chat. Says, great to see you with Lynette Zhang. Yeah, she is really, really cool. I like Lynette. I had never talked to her prior to that. And really awesome to get her insight. She's been in the markets for so long. And I don't know if you guys watched that interview, but I specifically asked her about her experience during Black Monday and the crash of 87. And she was a stockbroker at that time. So it's really cool to get her inside track on that. But she is why I am so much in gold and silver. Okay, cool. Until I got your opinion last month. Oh, as far as just a 10% allocation, I'm assuming that's what you're talking about, Tony. And I want to be clear, I'm a big fan of gold and silver. Silver more for a speculation, gold more for insurance. But I'm not a fan of having 100% of my portfolio in any asset class, whether it's real estate, gold, stocks, bonds, cash. I think that you've got to use diversification to your advantage unless you're trading, unless you really know what you're doing. And, you know, I'm trying to learn that end of it as well. Hopefully I'll get better at it. I can share that with you guys. But for right now, I just, I don't think you should have all your eggs in one basket. Okay, Vince, thank you for the super chat. Vince, reference your Hong Kong video. I asked on Twitter where the trillions of money and reserves in China went to and why they would not bail out Hong Kong, because China needs those dollars to bail themselves out. They've got the exact same peg problem that Hong Kong has. So I think Kyle Bass, again, said it much better than I ever could. And he was asked this specific question by Bloomberg or CNBC. And he said, listen, China's house is on fire, just like Hong Kong. So they can't afford to lend them any fire trucks. And I think that's the best way to look at it. You know, China's, their reserves have gone from $4 trillion down to $3 trillion, but they've got to defend their peg just like Hong Kong does. And that whole system is really, really has problems. When you set up your yield curve to where you have to adopt another country's yield curve, and that other country, their economy diverges with your economy, whether their economy slows down while yours is heating up or vice versa, you got big, 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 big problems. And the United States goes into recession, Hong Kong starts humming along, but they've got to drop their interest rates and take up ZIRP, zero interest rate policy, just like the United States did, or they'd lose that peg. And what does that do when you've got an economy that's humming along and is overheated, and then you drop interest rates on top of that? You've got some serious, serious asset bubbles coming your way. And that's what the real estate in Hong Kong is right now. And HSBC is a huge part of that. For those of you who didn't watch that video, I'd strongly suggest doing so. HSBC is 32% of their revenue is Hong Kong specific. And the banking system in Hong Kong is 850% of GDP. That is a big problem. And I had some people that I think were long Hong Kong telling me that, oh, it's not that big of a deal. There's a lot of, you know, like New York is financialized. So if you took just the GDP of New York and looked at the banking sector, it would be extremely high. And I totally agree with that. But the flaw in that, in my humble opinion, is that New York doesn't have to peg their currency to the dollar, right? They don't have to have all these reserves. They don't have a different currency. And I think it's more like looking at Singapore in the sense that not only is the banking sector to GDP, I don't want to say only, but it's a lot less than Hong Kong. It's about 600%. But also they've got a floating currency, so they don't have that peg problem. That's a big, big, big deal. And why that's a big deal is because if you lose that peg, interest rates go up. And when interest rates go up with 850% of your GDP but your banking system accounting for 850% of, I'm not saying that right, am I? All right. When your banking system is 850% relative to GDP and interest rates go up, and you got all that debt in the system, you got a big problem. Not only that, the private sector debt in Hong Kong is 300% of GDP. So there's a lot of issues there. Okay, so I'm just getting your question now, Baxter. Any ideas on how to play the virus becoming a major issue for China? I mean, from a fundamental standpoint, you just have to look at the markets, even the US market, and ask yourself, is this being priced in? And you've got two answers to that. Either yes, it is being priced in. And the reason why stock markets are still going to all-time highs is because they think that the Fed's going to inject all this liquidity and that's going to drive stock markets higher. So it's this, we go back to this bad news is good news type of situation. Or the market's just completely blowing it off as though it's a nothing burger and the market is offsides or potentially offsides. There's a lot of asymmetry there. So from a fundamental standpoint, I think that would really make sense. But the problem is you don't know why the market is going to all-time highs. And if it's going to all-time highs because bad news is good news, and then it comes out that the coronavirus is even worse, then all of a sudden the market goes up even higher because we're getting worse news. It's like bad news is good news, and horrible news is fantastic news from the standpoint of the market assumes that the Fed is just going to print that much more money. Okay, free parking. Thank you for the super chat. Asks, will you buy homes in Niagara Falls, New York? Will I or would I? I'm not sure that I will, but would I? It all depends on the RV ratio. So if your cost basis for the home is $100,000, and you're getting $1,000 a month in rent, that's a 1% RV ratio. If you could get that type of RV ratio there by in a good neighborhood with good school district, then I absolutely would consider it. But it all starts with the numbers. Hey, Brian, thank you for the super chat. Asks, given the 401k constraints that many of us are dealing with, Yeah, I know. This is a tough question. Cannot liquidate retirement assets until the age of 60. What would your investment portfolio advice be? Primary options, equities, cash, paper precious metals. Oh, man. Eesh. And I'm assuming you can't go short equities on that. And paper precious metals. Yikes. Well, I tell you, Brian, I would definitely go into the miners. And when I say go into them, I'm not talking about 100% of your portfolio, but that maybe 10% that's speculative, I would go into at least get some exposure to the miners. Because as far as paper gold, like the GLD, man, I don't like that because your counterparty is HSBC and no one wants that counterparty. For those of you who don't know, HSBC is the custodian of the gold for the GLD fund. Cash, I think that would be wise if you can keep it in T-bills and roll it over, like 3-month, 6-month T-bills. I'm not sure if that's an option with 401k, but if it is, I think that would be prudent. Again, with a portion of your portfolios. And then with equities, I don't know if maybe you could invest in foreign stocks that would be a little cheaper and would have a good dividend yield. Maybe I'd combine that with some dividend payers in the United States. If you could maybe find a REIT that was residential based, you know, you don't want to get into any of these REITs that are in the commercial and strip malls and whatnot, because then you can get Amazoned out of that trade. But that's probably where I'd start, Brian. I wish I had a silver bullet for you, but it makes it extraordinarily difficult when you're limited by that, and we're just in this everything bubble. And it really makes me angry when I see so many of these questions, and it's so relevant to the average American. And I look at what the Fed is doing, and you just connect the dots, and the Fed has put all these people like yourself, all these good, hardworking people that have produced more than they've consumed for their retirement. And, you know, they just drop interest rates to zero. You can't get a return. And the next thing you're doing is you're going as far out on the risk curve, just to try to make up for the gains that you're losing by not getting an interest rate on treasuries. And it's just really, really pisses me off, to be honest with you. But you know what? Let me give you some advice, Brian. Maybe this will help you. I'm interviewing a kid. This kid is sharp. His name is Marco, and he's got a YouTube channel that's called Whiteboard Finance. And he's a real, real smart kid. And his whole thing is personal finance. I don't really understand personal finance that much. You guys, I'm sure, probably know that. I know the macro side of it and the investing side. I totally get that. I can explain it well. But as far as the 401ks, the IRAs, you know, how to improve your credit score, what credit cards to use, I don't really know much about that at all, because I've never really used any of those. I've never really used a credit card. I've never had a 401k or an IRA. So I'm going to be asking him a lot of these questions for all of my viewers, just like you, Brian, that have these fantastic questions. I'm going to ask him, okay, you got a 401k, you can only go into equities. You know, can you go precious metals? Can you buy physical? I'm going to be asking him all these questions. So make sure that you stay tuned for that video. Okay, Funding Jim, how's it going, buddy? Yes, I know you're coming down here. Very, very cool. Seeking a 6-month lease in Medellin starting July. Do you have a website you recommend stable rents for next 18 months? Yeah. So Funding Jim, what you want to do is you want to talk to Angie, who is the one half of the husband and wife team, who's really in charge of all of my real estate projects in Colombia. They do all the remodels for me, but they also handle the property management. And Angie does that as kind of a side hustle, but she manages quite a few properties. So she's the gal that you want to talk to. If you want to email Sebastian, and that's at georgegammon.contact@gmail.com, and have him email you Angie's WhatsApp, and then just text Angie and tell her who you are, tell her you're a buddy of mine, and tell her what you're doing, and then have her start putting out the feelers for you. Coleman, thank you for the super chat. Question, how can you be a Puerto Rican resident but live in Colombia? Also, any suggestions on gold and the silver mining companies? All right, Coleman. I went to Puerto Rico for Act 20 and 22 in, I believe it was 2013, right around there. And I was one of the first people to do it. I did it for Schiff. But back then, there wasn't too many people. It was just a little small group of us. But the deal was, and I want to preface by saying, just take this with a grain of salt, because I know all the rules, not all, but a lot of the rules have changed since I went through the process. So you don't want to assume what I'm telling you or my experience is the same way it works now. The good news is that from what I've heard from buddies of mine, the process is even more liberal than it was back when they first started it. So back then, the way it worked is you had two options to maintain your residency in Puerto Rico. Number one, you had to be there. Well, for the first year, you had to be there for more than 6 months, which I did. And I think I was there most of the year. And then once you did that, then for on a moving forward basis, it's either for you got to be do it for 1 year, 3 years, something like that. But once you do that and you establish like firm residency there, then you can go to other countries. You don't necessarily have to spend 6 months in Puerto Rico, so long as you don't spend more than 3 months a year in the United States. So you've got one of two choices. Once you get past that initial phase, you can not spend more than 90 days in the US, or you spend 6 months in Puerto Rico and 1 day, and then you can spend the rest of your time in the United States. So depending on which way you want to go. But again, just to be very, very clear, though, that might not be the way it works now. So you definitely want to get in touch with a guy there or a gal, a lawyer that really knows their stuff. And if you want to email Sebastian, I can have him email you the contact of the guy I used. He was a big lawyer there. I don't know if he's retired since. I don't know if he's still doing it, but I'd be happy to share his contact email with you. And again, Sebastian's email, I think you just put it in the chat, was georgegammon.contact@gmail.com. Okay, Pierre Oliver, thank you very much for the super chat. Oh, I'm sorry, Coleman. I'm sorry. I missed half your question there. The second half of your question was any suggestions on gold, silver mining companies. For that, as far as specific bottoms-up approach to the gold miners, silver miners, I would defer that to my, hopefully, if it pans out, the interview that I have with Marin Katusa from Katusa Research. I don't think anyone knows more about that than he does, other than maybe Rick Rule. And so I'm going to really go just deep dive into that with Marin. So I would say stay tuned for that. And that's going to give you some good names and some actionable advice, as opposed to me just trying to guess. I don't want to do that. Again, just be clear, guys. I know a lot about the macro stuff and how things work. But as far as a bottom-up analysis on individual companies, I don't spend much time on that at all. Now, I want to in the future, to be clear, because I want to for my own portfolio, because I'm just like you guys. The same concerns that you guys have with your money, trust me, I have the same concerns, the exact same concerns. And I am concerned with hyperinflation. I'm concerned with a deflationary depression and an inflationary depression, the exact same stuff. So I'm going to be allocating a bigger portion of my portfolio to that in the future, because I'm selling a few of my real estate properties. And I'm just going to take you guys along with me. So whatever I do, I'm going to post it to the website. I'm going to share it with you guys on a video, and hopefully that'll help you better manage your finances or your portfolio. Okay, Pierre Oliver, in your last video, you said you won't make money into stocks. Maybe I won't put money into stocks. I'm in the miners. Should I sell and wait for the crash before entering those miners? What I got from Rick Rules, I should buy now. You've got to compartmentalize your portfolio, Pierre. At least, well, you can obviously do anything you want. I'm saying if you're a family member or one of my friends, this is how I would suggest doing it. You've got to have 10% in insurance, 80% in investments. That means it pays you to own it. And then 10% in speculation. And the miners, I would only consider those speculation. And I don't, for the speculative part of your portfolio, I think that could be a very interesting purchase right now. I completely agree with Rick. But when I'm saying that I don't suggest buying stocks right now, you've got to make sure that you take that, or you put that into context. And what I'm saying, I wouldn't do that as an investment. So I wouldn't buy Coca-Cola right now, where if the market crashed and I could get it at $20 a share, then I would definitely buy Coca-Cola as an investment. You see, that you've got to put the portfolio into different buckets, in my opinion. Okay, free parking. Thank you for the super chat. Doesn't the petrodollar make it hard for gold bugs to be right about the dollar collapse due to artificial demand? Please do a petrodollar whiteboard. That's a really good suggestion. I might even one up you. Free parking. I've got two videos that I'm contemplating doing. One is on the euro dollar. And if you think the petrodollar is important, wait till you see how important the euro dollar system is. That is, every once in a while I do a video where, you know, in all the comments, people say, oh my gosh, that blew my mind. That blew my mind. And if I do the euro dollar system video, that will blow your mind. And that's based on Jeff Snyder's work, of course, as you guys could probably guess. You guys are gonna have to, you're gonna have to buckle up for that one, because that will really, you're gonna have to put on your thinking cap for sure. But I think you guys will absolutely love it if that's the direction we go. So stay tuned for that video. As far as the petrodollar propping up the US dollar, because it creates artificial demand, to your point. But that said, you know, gold can go up for a variety of different reasons, and it doesn't always go up due to inflation. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. I think Rick Rule really outlines this best when he says that the gold's biggest competitor is the 10-year treasury. So if you want to know when gold is going to go on another big bull run, you've got to ask yourself the question when the U.S. Treasury is going to go on another bear run. And we all know that the U.S. Treasury has been in a down cycle as far as rates for the last almost 40 years, since 1981. And typically those cycles last 20 to 30 years. So at some point in time, we most likely will go into another up cycle in rates, meaning the price of the 10-year will go down because of that inverse relationship. But that's really the time when gold could go to, you know, 5,000, 10,000, who knows? But it doesn't necessarily have to be inflationary. Rates can go up like that, and it could happen without a lot of inflation. Now, that said, you could also see a situation where the 10-year goes negative. It's a lot less likely than rates being negative in Japan and Europe. And that's a whole like hour or two video. So I'm not going to dive into that right now. It's just the logistics, the way the Fed has things set up. It's a little harder from what I've seen to actually pull that off. But if they could get the 10-year into negative territory, then you're looking at the competitor for gold having, as far as a store of value, having a negative carry, a serious negative carry. It already has a negative carry in the standpoint that inflation rate is higher than the interest rate that you're getting on the 10-year. So we already have negative real rates. It's just if they go nominal negative, then they're going to go even further negative real. And then let's say you got a 3% cost of holding those treasuries when you factor in inflation. Then, although you may have a small carrying cost with gold to store it, or maybe not if it's in your backyard, then gold becomes much more attractive than a treasury. And in that case, it could go up in value substantially without seeing a lot of inflation. So that you get my point. I don't want to beat a dead horse, but it's not specifically tied to the petrodollar. that's the short story long right there. I'm trying not to go off on these tangents in the live stream, so you guys will have to bear with me. Could you please try to get an interview with Harry Dent? Yeah, I'd love to. He has a very different view of the U.S. dollar and precious metals. Yeah, because he's just looking at it strictly from a standpoint of demographics, which I totally get. There's a lot of different cross currents. I think that's some of the best advice that I can give you guys. The number one, I think, best advice I can give you is make sure you look at things through the lens of probabilities. And that I always tell you guys the, you know, the blackjack story. I'm sure you guys are familiar with that. And I've actually had quite a few people send me pictures that they went out and bought Beat the Dealer by Ed Thorpe on my suggestion. They do that on Twitter. So that's really cool that people are getting in that mindset. But that would be my best advice. But second would be to understand that when you're looking at the probabilities, it's not a binary decision in the sense that it's not that gold is just going down and that's it. You either think gold is going down or gold is going up because you believe Harry Dent or you believe Peter Schiff. Both of them are, in their own analysis, are correct. Meaning, Harry Dent is right that we do have a demographic problem, and that is deflationary. Peter Schiff is right that we are going to print a ton of money, and that is inflationary. When you're trying to analyze the probability of what is the most likely outcome, you've got to look at both of them and see them as cross currents in the ocean. So it's not that one cross current doesn't exist or that there's only one cross current or tide. It's that all these cross currents are combining into this soup, and you've got to figure out which is going to be the most powerful cross current. Is the demographic wave that Dent is talking about, is that a more powerful cross current than the Fed's money printing, or vice versa? That's the question you've really got to be asking yourself. And when you do that and you combine that with probabilities, I think not only are you able to see the macro landscape a lot better, but you're going to be able to make a lot better decisions with that 10% or whatever you choose, part of your portfolio that's allocated to speculation. Funding Jim, thank you very much for the super chat, buddy. Much appreciated. Question, worth it to keep Act 20 and 22? I haven't seen a benefit for keeping it. Let it go, 5K to keep it, otherwise Texan. Well, yeah, I mean, that's a great point. It all depends on your personal situation as far as it being beneficial. If you're like a W-2 employee, it's not going to be beneficial. But if you have a certain type of business, then it's going to be wildly beneficial. So it just really all depends on your personal situation. Okay, Conrad, thank you for the super chat. Can income from a multiplex count toward your yearly income when you apply for a home loan? I'm trying to find my max loan rate based on my salary. Yeah, for sure. But you got to remember that the debt is going to go against you as well, Conrad. So when you're submitting that to the bank, let's say you've got, call it an extra $2,000 or $3,000 a month coming in. That's great, but they're going to look at your outstanding debt. So if you've got $250,000 in debt against that asset that's yielding that $2,000 or $3,000, they're going to weigh that as well. So there's a lot of calculators online, Conrad, that you can use. That's what I would suggest. Just Google like a debt to income ratio or something like that, a debt to income ratio calculator, and then that can change too with banks. Some of them require a little bit more, a little bit less, but they're really just looking at your balance sheet and your P&L. So your balance sheet's going to have your assets and liabilities. Your P&L is going to show your income and your ability to service that loan. Okay, Conrad, thanks again for you got another super chat, buddy. Okay. Let me read this out loud for everyone here. I found a triplex for $1.25 million in California. Monthly income from rent is $6,500. Even with my VA perks, no taxes, my mortgage is still $6,300. Wait for a crash or YOLO. I'm not sure what YOLO is. Sorry, I'm so out of it. I'm so not cool and not hip. I don't know what these acronyms or these abbreviations are. I know FOMO. I know what that one is, but I don't know what YOLO is. But wait for a crash. I don't know if I'd wait for a crash. I just think about taking that your cash and moving it elsewhere. I mean, can't you qualify for a VA loan and buy a rental property or more than one rental properties outside of California? I assume that you'd be able to do that where you can get a 1% RV ratio. But see, with this is a great example. In order to get, and this is why I dislike California so much, in order to get that 1% RV ratio, you would have to have $12,500 coming in a month in rent. You're half of that. So you're at a 0.5 RV ratio. That is no bueno. So, I mean, I don't know if I'd wait for a crash, but I'd try to find a way to better allocate that those resources to a market where you could get closer to that 1% RV or maybe a 0.8. And then the problem becomes property management. And you got to make sure that you're on top of that. But you know, Jason can help you with that, jasonhartman.com. But I think that's the best advice. Just waiting for a crash. You know, what I might do if you're really hell-bent on California is I might try to invest outside with some of your assets and then take a portion of that and put it into short-term T-bills, just 3 month, roll them over, and just keep your powder dry. I might consider doing something like that for my own, if it were me. I want to make sure, you know, it's not investment advice. You got to say all that stuff. What I'm telling you guys on these live streams is I'm just pretending you're just my sister or you're just a good college buddy of mine that I'm just trying to give the best advice I can to. Okay, Chris, thank you for the super chat. When preparing your, I'm not sure what that word is. Okay, I'm just going to hop over that word. I'm not sure if I've, maybe I don't know what that word means, but when preparing your macro observations, that's funny. Okay. He says, when preparing your macro observations, do you prefer boxers, briefs, or going commando? Oh, I do say in these live streams, you can ask me any question you want. And I mean it. I mean it. When I'm preparing the observation, I don't know. When I'm doing my research, I just wear briefs or something. I'm pretty much old school, man. I wear the same underwear now that I did when I was like 7 years old and your mom would like write your name on the band when you went to summer camp. Stuff like that. So, no, my mom does not write my name on my underwear anymore. Although she probably would if I let her, but, all right. So there you go, Chris. That's the answer that I can give you. Victoria, thank you for the super chat. If fiat currency goes south, who can afford to buy stashed gold? Some wealthy, the government. If government, then will purchase it at a discount or confiscate? If so, how is ownership of gold a hedge? You're making a lot of assumptions, Victoria, that don't have a 100% probability of coming to fruition. So let's break it down. Who can afford to buy the stashed gold? I'm trying to figure out how I can say this without a whiteboard. I'm like Obama. Remember Obama used to have his teleprompter to do speeches? I've got to have a whiteboard to do it, know what I'm talking about, or else my mind just completely loses focus. But let's see, how can I break this down? Okay, first and foremost, you have to remember that if fiat currency tanks or goes south, to your point, gold doesn't necessarily go up in real terms. If gold went from $1,500 an ounce to call it $10,000 an ounce, it could do that in nominal terms. So gold would not increase your purchasing power. It would just maintain it. And so what would happen if inflation went up that high? Well, we'd probably go into a stagflation, but wages would also, to a certain extent, adjust. So not that it would adjust enough to compensate. I still think people's purchasing power as a whole would decrease, and so would their living standard. But if inflation goes to the point where gold is at $10,000 an ounce, and it's there in just nominal terms, in real terms, it hasn't gone up much, then, as an example, minimum wage isn't going to be, call it $7 or $8 or whatever it is. Minimum wage is going to be 50, right? So people are going to have more money to purchase that gold. If gold goes up to 10,000 as a result of pure chaos in the system and as a result of interest rates going up without that massive type of inflation, then you have a point. Then very few people are going to be able to afford it. But there are still going to be people that can't afford it, and they're going to be just fighting amongst themselves to buy that gold from you, in which case you would have a massive increase in purchasing power. So then let's go touch on your next question. If the government saw that, wouldn't they come in and purchase it at a discount? And therefore, you lose part of that purchasing power that the gold maintained. Well, they're, even if they don't confiscate it, Victoria, they're still going to do that in the sense that you're going to have to pay capital gains tax on it. So let's go back to the example. If it goes from 1,500 an ounce up to 10,000, and it only goes up in nominal terms, then you've still got to pay a capital gains tax on that. Let's call it just, I know it's higher than 10%, but just keep the math easy. Let's call it 10%. Then you're taking a $8,500 gain. So you'd have to pay $850 in cap gains tax, which would bring the money that's going to you, it would drop that. So then your purchasing power is actually lower than what it otherwise would have been if the gold just goes up and keeps pace with the rate of inflation. You'd actually lose purchasing power there. So my point is that the government can steal your purchasing power, even if you own gold, even without confiscating it. Let's remember that. And then if they do come in and confiscate it, then it's all about diversifying your political risk, which you guys have heard me talk about a million times. And that means storing your gold in a variety of different places that most likely won't confiscate it, or having a lot of your gold and jewelry. That's one thing that Mike Maloney pointed out that I think is very interesting, that regardless of who has confiscated gold in the past, as far as developed countries, and that would mainly be the United States, Australia, and the UK, they never took jewelry. So if that was something I was really worried about and I was in the United States, I mean, just get a necklace, and you can just wear that necklace around your put it in your purse or your bracelet around your wrist or whatever, and you hop on the next flight and you're good to go. So I think that's the best way I can answer that question. And to answer your final question, if so, is gold a hedge? Absolutely, 100% it is. Because it's not necessarily a hedge as much as it is insurance. It's insurance because it's most likely going to maintain its purchasing power. And if all your other assets that you own go to hell in a handbasket, then there is a good chance that that gold would increase in purchasing power to hopefully compensate for the lack of purchasing power and the rest of your portfolio going down. So I am a firm believer in gold. Hey, Philip, thank you for the super chat. Thoughts on Vegas housing market? Vegas housing market is interesting because you would think that it would be in a massive bubble, just like Seattle, San Francisco, Boston, places like that. But it just because it was kind of the poster child for being in a bubble pre-2007. But it's not cheap. Don't get me wrong. But it's not horrible. If you in the chart that I'd suggest you pull up is the price to income ratio. And when you look at the price to income ratio in Las Vegas, it's not great, but it's not horrible. So I don't think you could get a 1% RV ratio there. I don't think it's the best place you could invest, but I also don't think that it's the worst place you could invest either. And for any of you who are looking to buy in Las Vegas, make sure you email Sebastian, because my mom is a real estate agent in Las Vegas. And if I didn't mention her, she would have, I would have definitely heard it tomorrow. That's for sure. So mom, if you're listening, I'm giving your name out. I'm giving you a reference here, hopefully sending some people your way. So Sebastian's email is georgegammon.contact@gmail.com. And just email Sebastian and he can send you my mom's email and see maybe if she's got some opportunities that maybe I'm just not seeing. But that's the takeaway with the Vegas market. Not terrible, but not great. Free parking. Thank you for the super chat again, my friend. It says, thanks for answering my questions. Love the podcast. All right. Yes, everyone go check out that podcast. We're doing some neat stuff. And just so you know, we are improving the audio. And, you know, when we first started doing these podcasts, we were just throwing them up randomly. And we do have a very small team here. Sebastian actually handles that on his side. So, but we understand that we've got a lot of room for improvement, and we're every single week, we're trying to get better and better, improve the production value of not only the videos, but the podcasts. The next step is we're going to try to start focusing on the blog on the website and providing some really good value there as well. So just my point is with that podcast, it's going to, the audio is going to get a lot better to where it's on par with the podcast that you guys probably listen to all the time, like Macro Voices or my good buddy Chris with Quote the Raven. Got to give him props as well. Okay, Acrobat Mapping. Thank you for the super chat. Asks, this month China has rising inflation. Wow, that is unbelievable. They also have worsening employment and worsening GDP. That makes sense. You know what? The inflation might be because they're printing so much money. Yeah, I'd have to think through that one. But that, yeah, that peg, yeah. All right. I'm sorry, guys. I'm thinking through that out loud. I'm doing a whiteboard video in my mind as we speak. Are they at risk for 1980s stagflation? And can they raise rates to fight it like Volcker? I don't think so. I mean, they always can. I mean, Hong Kong could if they couldn't keep that peg, they could solve the problem by jacking rates like Volcker. That would bring in enough capital if they jack rates to 20%. That solves the peg problem. But, oh my gosh, that just crushes your economy. Let me put it to you this way. When we had the GFC, which, as you guys know, the banking system was a big part of that. Our banking system was right around maybe 100% or a little less, a little bit more of GDP. Well, Hong Kong's, like I said earlier, is 850%. China's is extremely high as well. They've got the consumer debt. They've got real estate bubbles. They've got private debt corporations. They've got sovereign debt. They've got, I mean, it's less of a problem in China because they got so much control over it. But man, they can do it, but it would just, also too, let's go back to 1980 when Volcker did that. Our debt to GDP was like 30%, 30. And if China or Hong Kong's debt to GDP or their debt in general was extremely low, then yeah, they could do that. And look at what our debt was outstanding, not just the debt to GDP on the public side, but the private side as well back in 1980. And look at how much damage Volcker inflicted on the economy by raising rates. And I'm not saying that he shouldn't have done it because it absolutely 100% was the right thing to do, but it just crushed the economy with very little debt. Just think what that would do to an economy that was completely over leveraged. It's just like your personal loans. Let's say that you're making $100,000 a year and you've got a car payment that's only $200 and you've got a mortgage payment that's only $1,000, but you're bringing in $8,000 a month. And let's just for a second put taxes on the side. You've got a lot of wiggle room there. So even if the interest rate on your car payment and your mortgage payment goes from, call it 5% up to 10%, it's not going to hurt you that bad. But if you're making $8,000 a month and your mortgage payment is $7,000 a month and your car payment is $500 a month at a 5% interest rate and interest rates go to 15%, you got problems. You've got real big problems. And that's the difference between, just giving you a real life example of the 1980s and the US, Hong Kong, and China right now. Okay, Coleman, thank you for the super chat. I have a duplex in Maine. I was going to refi about a month ago, but need to finish up my taxes. Let's see, rates have gone down since. Do I refi out or do I wait? I think that goes back to my number one rule in investing, and that is just first and foremost asking yourself if it's cheap or if it's expensive. If it's cheap, you buy it. If it's expensive, you sell it. You don't worry about the direction. So I would look at the debt right now that you're considering bringing onto your balance sheet, Coleman, and ask yourself that question. And since interest rates are near 5,000 year lows, I think it's a pretty easy question that debt that you're considering bringing onto your balance sheet right now is cheap, super cheap. Could it get cheaper? Yep. But that's not the question you ask yourself. You're not trying to determine the direction of a certain asset or bringing on that liability onto your balance sheet. You're just asking yourself, as of right now, what is it? When I started investing in 2012, and I look at all the investments that I've made since then, I've had a lot of winners, but I have had some losers. And every single time I've had a loser in my portfolio, it's because I thought to myself, oh, this is going up in price, so I bought it. Every single time that I've had a winner in my portfolio, I asked myself, is it cheap? And the answer was yes. And the next question is it going up in price? And my answer to that question was, I don't care, because it is so damn cheap right now that it's almost irrelevant. So that's the best advice that I can give you on that. Just start with that question. And I think it really, you can put the pieces of the puzzle together a lot easier and start answering those own questions or your own questions when they kind of pop up in the future. Jill, thank you for the super chat. I've heard you talk about Ford trucks. Yeah. Any other personal property picks for appreciation, art, antiques, etc.? I'm not an expert in any other, call it creative asset class, but there's definitely a lot of things that fit. I mean, tennis shoes for like these sneakers that kids collect and anything like that. It's if you become an expert on that, you can arbitrage it. You can buy it from someone who doesn't know the value and is selling it at a local level and sell it to someone who does know the value at a national level. I mean, even Gary Vee, I'm sure you guys all know who Gary Vaynerchuk is. You ever seen him when he goes to Walmart and he does, or the garage sales, and he does like these arbitrage things where he'll go into Walmart and like scan it when they got it on sale, buy it, and then just sell it on eBay just to a national market where it might not be hyper local and they might not have that particular product on sale. All that is an arbitrage play. It's just old school commodity trading arbitrage. And that's all I'm doing with those trucks. Yes, they are a store of value, 100%. But when you can also look at them in the sense that it's an arbitrage play where you're buying local on Craigslist and call it Portland, Oregon. And then you're taking that asset and selling it at a national scale to buyers in Connecticut and all in the Rust Belt and all these places where they don't have that truck and you're selling it on eBay. That's all it is. So I would just, anything that you're an expert in, I would just look at it through that lens. And I think that that's going to be a great money-making opportunity for you. Oh, Vahera, thank you, buddy. He's getting me up to speed on the lingo. He says, YOLO is you only live once. You do only live once, but I don't know if that's a prudent strategy for allocating capital. I think that's a better personal motto than it is an investment strategy. Andrew Smith, thank you for the super chat, Andrew. George is the best. Three simple, fast questions. That's funny. Who do you use for buying stocks, bonds, like a brokerage? You know, this tells you how long it's, I don't even pay attention to it anymore. I've got a couple foreign brokerages that I use, but you guys wouldn't know them. They're just these small, like in Cyprus, I talk about that. I can't remember the name of it. I get their statements, but it's been so long since I've talked to the guy. And I've just held those stocks forever. I was using Scottrade, but then they just switched it to TD Ameritrade, I think. But I all the big pros that I talk to use, what is it? It's the big, I'll have to look it up. I just talked to Mark Spiegel about this. And, you know, they email me all the time. Whatever the big one is that everyone, that all the pros use. That's one I'd use because it's cheaper. And if you want to short things, I think they'd have a bigger access to pools of stock that you could actually short. But again, I don't know if I'd take my advice on that, Andrew, because that's not my specialty. My specialty is figuring out how things work at a macro level. And as far as setting up brokerage accounts or what brokerage is better than the others. And as you can tell, I don't even know the names of them right off the top of my head. So I think there's better sources out there for that type of information than me right now. And in the future, when I start paying more attention to that, then I'll definitely share that that with you guys for sure. But right now, I'm just not really focused on that because I've got the majority and a huge majority of my portfolio just in real estate. So, all right. And the next part of your question, how do you adjust home prices for inflation? Any investment conferences you recommend? Thank you. So as far as that, the housing prices for inflation, you just Google that. Just pull up U.S. housing prices adjusted for inflation. And there's a few websites that break it down by cities, not every city, but a lot of them. And then you can also just look at them in nominal terms and then go to an inflation calculator that you can just type in a dollar in 1960 and then whatever today's date is, call it 2020, and then it'll tell you what that dollar would be. And then if you've got a nominal chart, you can just use that to convert it. Keep in mind that that's going to be using the CPI most likely, and we all know that the CPI understates inflation. So, but that's the way that I'd get around it. If you're in like a smaller market, like a Boise, Idaho, and you only have nominal information, that's the fast way that I'd do the math. I'd just look at an inflation calculator. Chris. Oh, he's expanding my vocabulary. I appreciate that, Chris. Erudite. I've never heard that word. Having or showing great knowledge or learning. Big fan. Keep up the good work. Well, thank you, Chris. I think that's, isn't that ironic that Chris is complimenting me on my great knowledge? And I don't even know basic English. He's having to tell me the words that he's using to ask me in the question. Just remember, guys, when you're on these live streams, when you're taking my advice, I almost flunked out of high school. So you're getting advice from a guy who has gotten a hell of a lot more F's in his life than he's gotten A's. I'll tell you that right now for sure. All right, Eric, thank you for the super chat. Okay. It says, George, you have gorgeous hair. All righty then. Thank you, Eric. I appreciate that. It's a nice compliment. To protect myself from hyperinflation, can I invest in that? Okay. I think, we got it. It's a joke. All right, Eric. Probably not. I don't know if you can take out a credit default swap on my hair. Maybe you could short a credit default swap on my hair. That really gets you into some seriously weird derivatives right there, but don't put it past Deutsche Bank. I'm sure they might have that option. Step number two, if we have hyperinflation, won't the real estate bought on leverage easily beat out any rise in gold? Yeah, but again, you're conflating the two parts of my portfolio, Eric, and that you're comparing gold to real estate, and they're completely separate asset classes, and I buy them to achieve totally different things. I think the best example I can give you is if you go into my closet right now and look at my shoes. And I've got, let's say, leather Gucci loafers, and I've got tennis shoes that I wear to the gym, Nike tennis shoes, let's say. And you're, a lot of people ask me, well, what's better, George, your Gucci loafers or your Nike tennis shoes? I don't know. And they say, well, you know, in hyperinflation, wouldn't your Gucci tennis shoes be better? Well, maybe, but that's not why I'm buying those two pairs of shoes. I'm buying them for completely different reasons. And I think that's the best way that you can look at gold and real estate. You're buying real estate not as a speculation. You're buying real estate as an investment. That means it pays you to own it. Therefore, you are buying the cash flow that that real estate pays you. Now, if you can buy that with 30-year fixed rate debt, then that is an added bonus, because now you are buying that cash flow, that dollar cash flow, with leverage that is going to depreciate as inflation goes up, or it's going to hold less value because you're paying it back with cheaper dollars. So it's just a really neat way to short the dollar, but it's an investment, right? Again, cash flow, where gold is just insurance. You're not buying gold because it pays you to own it. I'm not buying gold because I think it's going to go up in price or up in purchasing power for that matter. I'm just buying gold because I think it's going to maintain the purchasing power that I have in that portion of my portfolio. That's really, or it's going to maintain the purchasing power that I have in the majority of my portfolio, hopefully, if those other assets decline. So you've got to take a holistic approach to your the way you organize and set up a portfolio. I don't think you can look at them individually, right? You've got to look at how they work individually, but how they interact with one another as well. Wally, thank you for the super chat. Do you think it's possible that the Cerveza, or I didn't even call it the Cerveza virus, I called it the Cerveza sickness or something like that. But yeah, I don't even want to say the V word because, oh my gosh, YouTube's touchy about that. But I get it, what you're saying. And for everyone who doesn't know the inside kind of joke there, is that I can't say what's going on in China, the illness that they're having, or YouTube demonetizes my darn video. So I've got to call it something else, like the Cerveza flu or something. So Wally says, if you think that flu was deliberately unleashed on the world in order to have an excuse to pull the plug on the world economy, that wouldn't make a lot of sense to me. I'm not saying, I mean, that it was deliberately. Oh, man. Obviously, that gets into a conspiracy theory. And I'm not saying that conspiracy theories aren't legit. There's a lot of conspiracy theories that pan out or turn out to be real. I'm not saying there's a 0% probability that it could be this kind of grand scheme conspiracy. But I don't know that, even if it was a conspiracy and it was done deliberately, I'm not sure that's their rationale as far as an excuse to pull the plug. I would look at it more of an excuse to print just an insane amount of money and create inflation to reduce the overall debt load. Yeah, I'm pull the plug on the world economy. Yeah, I don't know that the central banks or the powers that be are trying to pull the plug on the world economy. I think they're trying to prop it up. I think they're desperately doing anything that they can to continue to prop up and or inflate these bubble economies that we have in the developed world. So that's my insight on that, Wally. Victor, thank you for the super chat. Thoughts on Iowa real estate market? You always talk about the Midwest. I'd like to hear your opinion on Iowa. Goes back to the numbers, Victor. I haven't looked at Iowa specifically. I would assume that there are places there where you can get a pretty darn good RV ratio. I'd start with that, and then I'd look at trying to get that RV ratio in a really good, awesome neighborhood that has great school districts, where there's most likely going to be a lot of demand from the type of renter you want for the next 10, 20 years, and a starter home. Make sure that it's a starter home. And I say this all the time, but it's worth repeating over and over and over again. When I'm talking about going in and getting these RV ratios, I'm not talking about getting an RV ratio with a $400,000 house on the lake that's an Airbnb rental. That is not what I'm talking about. Because if we have a downturn in the market, that you're going to lose your revenue stream there really, really fast. Where if we have a downturn in the market, depending on how bad that downturn is, there is a possibility that rents could actually increase with those starter homes, so long as they're in those good neighborhoods. If we have a prolonged depression, then you could see some downward pressure on rents. But initially, you would see upward pressure, just like we did in the housing bubble back when it crashed in 2009 or 2008 through 2012. So all real estate is not created equal. It's not only local, but it's by specific, well, it's not just local, but it's how you buy it. It's what category that real estate is in. There's a lot of factors at play there. Okay, Conrad, thank you for the super chat. I'm stuck in California. Maybe start with a single family home, then work my way up to larger units as equity builds. Fear the VA loan could disappear in a crash. Yeah, it is true that debt is a lot harder to get. I know when I first got involved with real estate, it was impossible to buy anything single family with debt, unless you would add just an awesome relationship with a bank, which I did not have back then. I was just in a very, fortunate situation where I had just retired. So I had a lot of cash that I could buy these things without taking on any leverage or without having to partner with a bank. But I see the problem there, Conrad, is I don't want you to get overly obsessed with the upside of that VA loan to where it allows you to rationalize taking on excessive risk in the California market. I mean, I totally get it I think it's a tax-free, there's a lot of advantages with that. I'm assuming it's a lower interest rate as well. I'm assuming you have a lower down payment. But although those are good things to have, you've got to weigh those with the negatives. And I just, even if you're getting all those awesome perks, if you've got a negative carry on California real estate, man, you are putting yourself in a world of hurt if prices go down. Let's just think that through for a moment, okay? Because I think it's really important people understand this. If you've got you said it was a $500 in rent, and you've got a the mortgage payment is $6,300. Well, okay, now you got property taxes, now you got occupancy rates, now you got maintenance, now you got all these things. So you're going to be upside down on that property, call it $1,000 a month, easy. And let's not forget that the pension system, the state pension fund in California, is completely broke, like totally insolvent. There's no chance at all that they can fulfill their liabilities, meaning the promises that they've made to the people that are expecting that cash from that pension on a moving forward basis. There's no chance that they can fulfill those. The only release valve is going to be taxes. And if you look at what's happened in Illinois and other places, I know of just Illinois, but if my memory serves me right, they've been doing this in other states as well. The first place they go is property taxes. And I know that California has that law that passed in the late 1970s where they put a cap on the property taxes they could charge. But listen, man, they can repeal that. And I know they'd have, you know, people in the streets with pitchforks, but I think that's the only way out for them. And they're going to have a hell of a lot more people on the streets with pitchforks if they can't pay out those pension benefits to the people that they've guaranteed them to. So my point is that you're going to be upside down on that thing, $1,000 a month. So you've got $1,000 a month that's coming out of your current income that's going to pay that, just in hopes that it appreciates in value. And then if it doesn't appreciate in value, let's say it goes down and we have another 50% crash. Okay, now all of a sudden you've got an albatross around your neck. You've got a weight on this massive weight on your shoulders that you cannot get rid of. You cannot liquidate it without taking a massive hit and actually paying the bank to take it off your hands. And your other option is just to continue to pay $1,000 just for the honor of having this albatross around your neck for the next 30 years. I don't like that. I just don't like it. So I'm not going to tell you what to do. I'm just going to tell you that if it were me, there's no way that I would do that. Oh, I'm sorry. Free parking. I'm on these live streams. Sometimes it's hard for me to, a lot of times I obviously misspoke on that. So I apologize. If I said EV ratio, guys, I apologize. Again, it's hard on these live streams to articulate everything that you're trying to say properly. I meant RV, as in rent to value ratio. And that's the amount of rent that you're collecting, gross rent that you're collecting per month relative to your cost basis. Meaning if you have $100,000 out of pocket for the property, are you getting $1,000 a month in rent? If you are, that's a 1% RV ratio. If you're getting $500 a month, then that is a 0.5% RV ratio. You want, ideally, you'd want 1% or more. Dimitri, thank you for the super chat. George, I'm an experienced sports memorabilia collector. There you go. Exactly. I'm well known in the hobby. Should I continue to increase my collection or divert that money into metals? How would collectible do in a reset? I mean, what I would do is I would just use your expertise, Dimitri, as cash flow. I just use that arbitrage opportunity. And then, you know, my best pieces, I'd keep them as a store of value. But I'd take, I'd flip them and just keep that cash flow. And with that cash flow that you have coming in, I would take a portion of that to put into gold as a further insurance policy, or maybe into some miners, maybe silver, if you want to speculate a little bit. But I don't think it's a binary question. I don't think it's a do my sports memorabilia or do metals. I think it's a combination of both. And I think if you're an expert in that, that's just a great way to have a side hustle where you're making $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 a month, and you're taking that and allocating it into maybe buying more and growing that business, but also diverting some of those funds into a more diversified portfolio. So if we do have an issue with the economy, that you can take advantage of that. Geo Rob, thank you for the super chat, buddy. See you on here all the time. Just want to support the channel. Thanks for all your amazing content and hard work. Thank you very much, Geo Rob. I appreciate that, buddy. Jeremy, thank you for the super chat. When, where, and what was your best ever investment? Well, the best return that I ever had was investing, starting a business. That was by far the best ROI. But I don't think that's your question. I think you're asking me as far as what we would consider like an actual investment, not starting a business, not an entrepreneur type of thing. In that case, it's by far the real estate that I bought in Kansas City in 2012. I loaded up on all of those starter homes that I'm talking to you guys about. In fact, the very first day that I bought property in my life, you guys have to remember, prior to 2012, I not only didn't even know what the Federal Reserve was or is, I didn't know what bonds are. I mean, I didn't know any of that stuff. I knew a lot about business. I knew a ton about business. I knew how to make money. But I didn't know anything about macro or investing. I had never owned a piece of real estate in my life, not even one. I always rented. And the very first day that I bought a piece of real estate, this was in August of 2012, it was at the tax auction, the tax foreclosure auction in Kansas City on the Missouri side. And I bought 6 houses, just boom, baptism by fire. And after about a month, I bought more and more and more and more. And so those homes that I flipped a lot of them, but the homes that I actually kept in my rental portfolio, those have just been complete home runs because, I mean, my cost basis on those things was between, I mean, it was obscene. It was like between like 60 grand and maybe 75 grand all in. And I was getting between $1,000 and $1,200 a month in rent for those. And since then, all of them have appreciated to now they're probably worth at a minimum 150 grand between 150 and 175 grand. And so that's why you got to buy cheap. You got to buy cheap. But remember, even back then, I wasn't buying the real estate, assuming that it would go up in price. I was just buying cheap cash flow. So that was the biggest as far as ROI that I've had. But in Colombia, I've had a lot of home runs as well. But that's more, not really investments, because there I'm buying them and I'm remodeling them and flipping them. And that's more of like a small business. So I don't know if that would qualify as an investment. Oh, and then the stocks that I bought in Cyprus, those were a huge home run too, because now I'm getting like a 20% dividend yield on them just because I bought them so cheap. So that was a really fantastic investment as well. And most of the other investments have been just real estate driven. You got gold, but again, that's not really an investment. That's just, and then speculation, I haven't really done much of that. That's more what I want to do in the future. So that's how I'd answer that question. John, thank you for the super chat. If Bernie Sanders wins and establishes rent control nationwide, can real estate remain profitable stateside? Whew. It sure can. It sure can. I think that would be a horrible idea. I mean, that would be a terrible idea. But for those people that did own homes, it would give prices a huge tailwind on a moving forward basis, because that would reduce the supply of housing. That's what rent control does. Any price control is going to reduce the supply. So if you're reducing supply, if demand continues to go up, then that's going to put pressure on prices. And the only way to relieve that pressure is to allow the free market to work, get rid of the rent controls, bring in more supply, and then you have an equilibrium. But it would be a hell of a lot more difficult from a landlord standpoint, because then it just, all the regulations and the bureaucracy and all the red tape that you have to deal with. And then also from a renter standpoint, it makes things, in my opinion, on net balance, a lot worse, because you're getting much crappier living conditions and actually at a higher price. Most of the renters don't realize that a lot of times rent goes up a lot more than it otherwise would have with rent control, because they're allocating a specific increase in there. So they never say rent control, meaning you have to keep them at this price forever. What rent control normally does is they'll say, okay, you can bump it 7% a year, but no more than that. Okay, well, if I'm a landlord, well, I'm going to bump it every single opportunity that I have to bump by 7%, I'm going to do it. Absolutely. Why wouldn't I do that? Whereas if rent control weren't there, you'd have more supply, I'd have more competition, and I might not be able to increase my rents by that much per year. It might be a lot less than that. And also, if I'm a landlord thinking, okay, well, they're going to come in and institute rent control, if they've crossed that line, then I'm saying to myself, okay, when are they going to cross the next line and say that I can just never, ever, ever increase rent again? And therefore, if I had someone, like right now, I've got renters, believe it or not, that I still have that came into my properties in 2012. They're still there paying rent. These people, obviously, I've got a history with them. And because rent control isn't in place right now, and even if rents go up, let's say the market price is $1,400. If I've got a, you know, if let's say they're at $1,300, I'm going to be a little less anxious to increase their rent, because I know they're good renters. I've got a history. They're not going to mess up the place. They're not going to punch holes in the wall. But if I'm under rent control, and I know that opportunity may be gone, and I've got to somehow keep up with inflation, then I would. And there's going to be a lot more demand, because there's so much less supply. You're going to have more demand from renters. And therefore, you know that the landlords know that if they kick out that renter, they're going to have a waiting list of 20 people. So I won't go off on a tangent here like I've already done. But the point is that very well could put upward pressure on prices. Not that I think it's a good thing. Question, Acrobat Mapping again. Thank you very much for the super chat. Commodity prices never lie. Lumber prices surging in USA. Yes, and for that, make sure that you guys stay tuned to my buddy's YouTube channel, The Uneducated Economist. Really a great dude, and he's got his finger on the pulse of a lot of commodities like that. You think this is a good year to start another housing bubble? We're already in another housing bubble. We've already started. If you look at LA, look at a lot of these markets and look at them, the prices, even adjusted for inflation, they're just as high, if not higher, than they were in 2006. Would anyone on the live stream right now suggest that we were not in a housing bubble in 2006? I'd probably guess no one. So if you're not going to say, so if we were in a housing bubble in 2006 and prices are higher now, how are we not in a bubble now? That makes no sense to me. So has the demand side of the equation changed that much? Well, maybe. I mean, interest rates have gone down, but that doesn't mean that the demand side can't flip on a dime, nor does that mean that interest rates can't spike on a dime. Look at the repo market. Okay, Sebastian's telling me to check the time. All right. Oh, yeah. Hour and a half. Okay. Guys, thanks for sticking with me this long. I'm going to no more super chats because I'm going to finish up the ones that we have here. And then I'm going to call it a night so I can make sure that I can do that video tomorrow morning. Vara, thank you for the super chat. When you buy miners, will you be looking for 10 baggers like Doug Casey, or are you looking for growth built in like Sandstorm? Yeah, Jason. From Wall Street, from Main Street. If you guys hasn't checked out his channel, make sure you do that as well. Jason's a great guy and one smart dude as well. Or a combination. It depends on what part of your portfolio you're looking at. If you're looking at it as a speculation, I would look at the miners. If you're looking at an investment and you've got a product like Rick Rule is trying to build with Sprott, where they actually pay you a great dividend, then I would 100% look at that as a great place or a great investment for that bucket in my portfolio. But if I'm just looking at the speculations, then I'm 100% looking for 10 baggers. And why is that? Because remember, it goes back to making sure that mathematically over the long run, and make sure that you're using a binomial calculator for this, that the probabilities suggest that if you make that bet 100 times, that you're going to come out with a 95% or higher probability of winning. And the way that we do that, and if you guys haven't watched my video on it's not really on Tesla, I just named it that, so forget the title. It's more on probabilities. If you haven't watched that video, make sure that you do that. Very, very important. And we've got three components that we have to pay attention to. Number one, you've got to try to figure out the probability of an investment doing what you think it should, going up. Okay, let's just call it that. And then you've got to look at how many times you can make that bet. That's your volume. So you've got probabilities, you've got volume, and then you have asymmetry. You've got to get all three of those things right. Okay, so let's start off with probabilities. If you take, let's say, 10 bets on the gold miners, By definition, because it's such a bad business, even according to Doug, you're not gonna get a high percentage of those right. So let's say you get 30%. Okay. Well, if you can only make that bet 10 times, that's not very many times. And so you've got right off the top of my head, I'd have to look at the binomial calculator, but let's say you've got a 10% chance of getting zero right out of 10. Because with a 30% probability, you would at only 10 spins of the wheel. So if there's a 10% probability that you get zero right, that means over that amount of bets that you don't have more than 95% probability. Therefore, in my opinion, that strategy would not work. Unless you've got that wouldn't even work. Because you've got the 10% on the zero side. But let's say that you had a 40% of that. Now you're going to have less. You're going to have the 95% number. You got that. But then you've got to have enough asymmetry to where if you do have four winners or even three winners, hopefully even two winners and eight losers, that you're still going to come out net positive. So that's why you've got to look at, so where does volume come into play? Okay, well, even if you don't have a lot of asymmetry, let's say that you've got a 60% chance. So 6 out of 10 are going to come out winners. And you've only got a 1-to-1, meaning you're only going to make a dollar, but you have a chance of losing a dollar. Okay, if you do that over 10 times, that's not really a great investment strategy because, again, you've got a high probability or a higher probability than you'd like of getting 4 right where you're going to be a loser. But if you're able to make that bet 100 times, well, now all of a sudden, you've got the law of large numbers on your side, and you're going to be able to achieve that 95% or higher probability of coming out ahead. In fact, out of 100, you'd probably be a lot more, probably be more than 99.5%. So I know this sounds confusing, but if you go back to that Tesla video, watch that, and I think it'll all make sense. And I'll be incorporating a lot of that mindset into future videos on investment strategies, where I've got a whiteboard, and like Obama, I'm a lot better. I've got to have my mental crutch with me, or as you can see, I go off on all these tangents and lose my train of thought. William, thank you for the super chat. What do you think of Nashville? I used to like Nashville a lot. I know I really looked at that market in 2012, but I haven't looked at it really extensively since then, William. So I know it was fantastic, but I think it's getting a little hot right now. And I don't know if you could get those 1% RV ratios or even 0.8 unless you really, really get some bad areas. And I would not suggest that. So yeah, I don't have an opinion on that. I know it used to be great, but I don't know what it's like right now. Dynamite, thank you very much for the super chat. What's your take on speculative stocks like miners in the event the virus gets worse? Do you think they will be included in the market sell-off into cash? If so, would you consider holding or selling? That is so difficult to answer because I just don't know what the Fed's response is going to be. Like if the Cerveza flu gets out of control, comes to the United States, is the Fed going to increase their balance sheet by $1 trillion? Or are they going to increase it by $10 trillion? I don't know. So I don't. Then you've got to look at the Treasury General account. And I can't remember which video that was. I think I put Trump on the thumbnail or something like that. But if you guys haven't watched that video, you really got to watch that one as well. Because now the Treasury has this TGA, Treasury General account, with the Fed. And that thing is up over $400 billion. So my point is that the Treasury now is in a position where they can get around the Fed and do their own quantitative easing. So, and I'm not saying this is going to happen, but it very well could, where Trump calls up Mnuchin or whatever and says, release the hounds. And he just drops $200 billion into the market, meaning they spend $200 million. That goes into the reserve accounts of the banks, and they use that as money to give out loans and do whatever. That drives up stock prices just to juice the market for the election, or to juice the market, even if the Fed doesn't want to play ball with the Cerveza flu and the Fed only wants to inject, let's say they only want to bump their balance sheet by 500. Okay, well, the Treasury can bump it another 500. There's just so much funny money and so much liquidity sloshing around. And like Jim Grant says, it's just such they financialize the economy so much. And it's such a hall of mirrors. You just really can't know what is up or what is down. And that's the best answer that I can give you. It's really frustrating. I know. It's frustrating for me too. But I would assume that gold would go up because of the uncertainty. And the miners should go up as a result of gold going up. But again, it just, that's what should happen. But the market shouldn't be at all-time highs right now either. So take that for what it's worth. All right. Hi, Viz Capitalist. Sebastian's saying they keep sending super chats. Guys, I really appreciate the super chats, but we've got to hold off on those because I don't want to not answer them. And I've got to eat and I've got to make sure that I'm prepared to do the video tomorrow, or else we really get behind. So Hi Viz Economist, you don't need a conspiracy to explain the Kung Flu. Yeah, SARS has officially been released 4 times since 2002. Human error lab procedure, yeah. I hope this time is what you stick to for your Q&A, by the way. 4 p.m. is drag. Okay. Yeah, I'll probably stick to this because I notice that we get a lot more people. So I really appreciate all my friends and supporters in other time zones, but it looks like this is where we reach the most people. Oh, and by the way, guys, before I forget, next weekend, live stream will be at 7 o'clock, but it'll be on Saturday. It will not be on Sunday. It will be on Saturday at either, well, maybe 4 o'clock. It's a weird situation next week because Jason might join us on the live stream to do a live stream that's more real estate driven. I like to do those once every maybe 6 weeks or so. So I've got to kind of work around his schedule. So make sure that you check the channel next Saturday to see when we're going to have that live stream. It might be Saturday and it might be a different time. Darren, why don't you believe in Bitcoin? Darren, I do believe in Bitcoin. I think Bitcoin is fantastic. I love it philosophically, but I just don't think it's insurance. That's it. I think it's a fantastic speculation. I definitely want to do more homework. I definitely want to buy Bitcoin for the speculative part of my portfolio as soon as I get some liquidity from selling some of my real estate. And I'm going to take you guys on that journey with me because I know very little about actually buying it, but I'm going to do that. So it's not that I don't believe in Bitcoin. It's just I don't think it should be part of the other buckets of my portfolio. I just think it should be in that speculative bucket. Again, it goes back to you're comparing my Nike tennis shoes with my Gucci loafers. It's not which is better. It's they're both fantastic for different reasons. Okay, guys, thank you very much. I appreciate it. And I'm going to grab some dinner. Make sure you check out the podcast. Make sure you go to the website. Put in your email address. The benefit to you is you're going to get some original content on a moving forward basis. And then I think that's it, guys. We will see you on tomorrow's video.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.